Thanks for coming. That's what they mean by sitting come what may. Whatever merit my words have today, I would like to dedicate to my beloved dog, Sumi, who passed away on Friday while I was here at Chikoji. I don't know where she is right now, what new adventure she's up to. But I want her to know that I'm sorry that I was unable to be there with her as she crossed this threshold. I want to thank her for being my teacher for 14 years. So, this is for you, Sumi. It's kind of an appropriate weather for my mood. Also kind of appropriate for a talk on I Don't Know. Because when the lights go out, there's this sense of, little sense of panic. It's happening. Stormy weather, can't see clearly, feels tumultuous, a little dangerous, windy, and there's this feeling of I don't know what's going on. I'm kind of in the dark here. So this is good scenery for this talk today. This I don't know mind could be called a form of ignorance. And ignorance doesn't have a very good name and reputation in Buddhist practice. It's the source of a lot of trouble. Often discussed as the first in the series of this chain of dependent origination, which leads to suffering. So ignorance is often seen as the cause of suffering. And of course our practice is not merely about suffering. It's also about, very at the core, about the end of suffering. And so there are ways out of suffering. And so we presumably want to move out of ignorance, out of this don't know state. But of course, there's also something called beginner's mind, which has the implication of a form of ignorance. Beginners are generally ignorant. So I've been considering the relationship between the ignorance that is the cause of suffering and the ignorance which is the relief of suffering. And I think there's a form of ignorance which we could say is a blank slate. It's nothing on the slate. It's a kind of childlike, infantile ignorance. It's a form of mindlessness, actually. And then, of course, there's the ignorance of the slate that's too full, which is the pretentiousness, which is a form of ignorance which takes, in which one would say, I think I know something. And in fact, I think I know a lot. There's this Zen story about, you may have heard it, about this scholar, this Buddhist scholar, who goes for counsel with a Zen master and wants to learn more from this master. And the master gives him an audience, makes him, has an appointment with him for tea, and the scholar arrives to tea, and he begins telling the master all of his experiences, all of his scholarship, all of the things that he's discovered in the course of his academic career. And as he's doing this, the master is pouring him tea and keeps pouring and pouring and pouring. And before you know it, the whole floor is flooded with tea as this scholar is going on and on and on about his understanding of Buddhist practice. And suddenly he notices that the master hasn't stopped pouring his tea. And he says, what are you doing? My cup is overflowing all over the place. And the master says, this is how your mind is. This is my teaching to you today. You come with an empty cup if you want to learn something. If you come with a cup full of fixed ideas, you can't learn anything. So there's a form of ignorance, of I don't know, which is actually a pretense to knowledge called having fixed ideas. It's the person who thinks he or she knows it all. And that is the first sign of ignorance. So that is another form of ignorance, also a kind of mindlessness, both of which lead to suffering. The ignorance which is completely vacant, just blank, which you're sort of walking around like a zombie. And the ignorance which is so dense with pretense to knowledge, with fixed ideas, that nothing can enter. It's just opaque. The mind is opaque. It's full of rigidity. But I think what beginner's mind is also a form of ignorance. But it's an ignorance which is achieved. It's a state of mind which you arrive at after lots and lots of dead ends, pretenses, distortions, suffering. So it's almost a form of chosen ignorance. You can choose to have beginner's mind. You can choose to approach your life with this sense of open spaciousness. Some of you may know a jazz trumpeter. Thank you. named Miles Davis. Anybody heard of him? Famous. And he gave a concert at the Isle of Wight in 1970, which is considered one of the most astounding pieces of jazz ever performed. And one of the members of the band, named Keith Jarrett, who is also a jazz musician, pianist, was speaking about how the band managed to achieve such extraordinary music that night. It's one of those rare experiences of transcendence that music can often bring us to. And Jarrett said that that night, each of the members of the band chose to be ignorant of what exactly was going to come next. What notes were going to come next? There was an unspoken agreement that all the band members could feel that they were willfully surrendering to moment after moment, not having to know what was going to come next. Even though he said their heads were completely together, they were not just sort of randomly, sloppily opening themselves to whatever. They were very focused. But underneath that focus, and I suspect that they had to be quite extraordinarily focused to be so trusting of each moment, to tell them what the notes needed to be. If you watch this, I was not at the Isle of Wight, but I've watched this and listened to this 37-minute piece of music many, many, many times. In fact, there have been some music critics who have said that they wouldn't cross the street for a free trumpet jazz concert because the trumpet isn't typically the most exciting instrument in jazz. But that he said that he could listen to this piece over and over and over and never tire of it. And I kind of feel the same way about it. And when you watch Miles Davis approach each note, it's something that can't be captured on a CD or it's something you just have to intuit. And so I offer this illustration in the form of a question. What would life be like if we approached each day, each moment, with this willful ignorance? I don't have to know what the next notes are going to be. In fact, it's better that I don't. But to give myself in this spacious beginner's mind to whatever presents itself, to be available to it, to be fully present to it. So what would life be like if this was our approach, like Miles Davis' approach to each note? I have a feeling that we'd have quite an intimate experience with each day. It would deepen and increase our intimacy with life. If our approach to experience were not mediated by our knowledge, I don't know. So much of our lives, our way of being in the world, is mediated by ideas and knowledge, because this enables us to control things, to master things, and to feel at home. So when the lights go out, we can keep the lights on, and that's what our knowledge does for us. Keep the lights on so that we can see clearly and feel like we're navigating the way we want to. But when the lights go out, when the storms blow, when the rains begin to drench the earth, and there's darkness, how do we navigate? Where's our true north? Can we trust this? Can we trust each moment? Can we open to letting go of that barrier between us and what presents itself moment after moment? That barrier of knowledge and of thinking, of approaching the world through concepts, through analysis, keeps us at a distance from it. And of course, that helps us control it, of course. We keep our distance. So if we eliminated that barrier and kind of start dissolving it and feeling this ability to trust each moment, to trust this spaciousness, we wouldn't have that separation so much. We could enter into a greater intimacy with each thing as it presented itself. We could experience the rain without calling it rain. What would that be like? We've had that opportunity this morning, just to hear these notes and trying to get underneath the concept of rain, which gives us some power over it. What would it be like to experience somebody's touch without feeling it as either aggressive or romantic or opportunistic or hot or cold, or but just this? And this goes for all of our senses: taste, touch, smell, even seeing something without having to name it. When we sit, we experience sensations, and we call these sensations sometimes pain. I have pain in my knee. But that pain, that concept, pain, that knowledge about pain, separates us from that sensation. And then we start thinking, oh, well, maybe this is because of an old injury, or maybe I should move my foot, or maybe this is because my mother dropped me on my head when I was 3 years old, or maybe I'm going to be crippled for life, and you know, on and on and on. And there we're off to the races, into the world of suffering, more and more distant from that sensation. When I was a graduate student, I took a minor in painting. And I remember having a wonderful teacher who knew, I think, about Buddhist practice deeply. And I was painting a still life and in the studio, and he came over to my canvas and he said, What color is that? What color are you painting the wall? And I said, gray. And I was indeed painting it gray. And he said, which wall are you painting? And I said, that wall over there. He said, well, come with me. Let's take a look at this wall. And we went over to the wall, and he said, now I want you to really look at this wall and tell me what you see. Do you see gray? And so I looked and looked and looked. Of course, my first reaction was resistance. Yes, I see gray. But then I willfully chose to be ignorant, just for a split second. And thought, okay, I'll really look. I'll listen to it. Really look. And I really looked. It wasn't gray at all. It was blue and red and pink and green, and I really saw all kinds of colors in what I was concluding was gray. It's concluding this. This was a conclusion, not something that I actually saw. But of course, I also didn't see blue or gray, green or red or purple. Because those were names too. Mine's. But at least I broke through the gray. At least I got that far. And I learned an important lesson. That so much of my experience I was approaching through concepts, through thinking. And that it was truly helpful and deeply satisfying to disengage. Not that we can stop thinking, but to disengage from it every now and again. To practice that disengagement so we can become more intimate with life. And this disengagement I'm calling I don't know mind. Choosing to settle and dwell for a while in don't know. It's kind of repeatedly, it's kind of a mantra. Yeah, you know, these robes and everything. This really big sign, you know, I need help. I need lots of help. So I'm always looking for mantras and dharanis and tips, practical tips. Living fully and relieving suffering. And this is these four talks that I'm going to be offering, in a way, are mantras. Don't know. Something comes, don't know. It's a useful mantra. Don't know. My dog's dying. Don't know. Opens a door. Opens a gate. It feels that this image in my mind of seeing once a young girl, could be Leanna, for all I know. Yeah, Leanna and you. Stop. But this was in Pennsylvania, and I was driving down a road and just happened to pass by a house where this little girl was standing on a ledge around her house, and her dad, must have been her dad, looked like her dad, was like this. Jump! He was going like this, and she was like that, and I watched her jump into her father's arms. And I felt so instantly that this is the way to live. This is the way to live. And I guess there's even a Zen, I don't know if it's a koan or not, but where someone's standing, guy is standing with one foot on a 6-foot pole, and the koan is, you know, what do you do? You jump. Just jump. Very simple. But is that hard? Just jump. And what does that take? It takes this trust. I don't know. I don't know whether I'll be caught. But I trust. I trust. Oh, I forgot something. I wanted to share something with you. This is a quotation that one of my Sangha members from Pennsylvania gave me before I left for Chukotji. She gave me a little worry stone along with this, knowing that I probably worry. But this is a quotation from Reginald Ray. Do you know him? I think he's a popular writer. But it's appropriate for today. True Dharma. Dharma is not about credentials. It's not about how many practices you've done or how peaceful you can make your mind. It's not about being in a community where you feel safe, or enjoying the cachet of being a Buddhist. It's not even about accumulating things, teachings, empowerments, or spiritual accomplishments. It's about how naked you're willing to be with your own life, and how much you are willing to let go of your masks and your armor and live as completely exposed, undefended, and open human person.
Life becomes like an art when you're being known in that way. Everything you do, every moment. In essence, like actual art, music, dance, film, and when I guess when it's inspired, that's what they, that's what it is. Surrendering, channels open, and yet there's intense. The art part, there's like a lot of practice before that, which is amazingly when it's so rooted in, I guess, the form, the precision of it, and yet there's that divine surrender, and that's to me what makes art great.
Yeah, there's the phrase, the art of living. And we do develop techniques and strategies, but that may be more the science of living. All those techniques that we've mastered, the technology of living. But then there's the mystery, the surprise, the technique that doesn't work, the lights that go out. No matter what we do, no matter how much control we exercise, no matter how great our science is, the lights are going to go out. And that's where life begins, that creativity that you're talking about. That's where the art of living, I think, emerges. And it is a creative act because it's done in the context of mystery, in don't know. You've got to be creative because you have nothing to fault. All your techniques have failed. So you got to find it somewhere, invent it.
Good observation somehow. I had a Lavener theory that ties a little bit with this. That's something I've been puzzling about throughout 40 years. It's about this anatara samyak sambodhi, complete perfect enlightenment, and how what I see is not bad at all. I see teachers that are much better than I am, and like Michael, much, much better than I've ever considered being, knowing more and more about him. And above him, there are many others, like Reb Anderson, who are incredibly powerful, and the great ones like Copan and maybe Trungpa Rung, Rinpoche, etc. But they just keep going up. And then the immortal Buddhas like Dogen and Bodhidharma. Where does this complete come from? In my mind, was what I was struggling with for years, and I think it's a kind of egolessness that you arrive at, maybe that a Buddha could arrive at. And when you arrive at it, you are in the art of just living, but at the same time, you are the Dharma. So this process that's going on has no ego, and therefore you're done. That may be the end of this culmination of greater and greater and greater, or maybe less and less and less perspective.
Yeah, sometimes our practice is described as a process of subtraction.
Yeah.
That is in our sort of ordinary approach to things. You speak of greater and greater and greater as an accumulative thing. You know, we become bigger and bigger and bigger and greater and greater. And often we think about our practice as becoming smaller and smaller and divesting more and more, divesting more and more, so that we reach a place of the metaphysical onion. You know, you peel away the layers and there's nirvana, extinction. There's nothing there. But the way is to subtract. And we think about learning and accumulating experiences and accumulating books and knowledge and, as I read here, practices and accomplishments and this and then the robes and then the brown robes and then the pink robes and then the crowns and whatever, all the bells and whistles, and we just keep accumulating all these things. But I like Coben, I think it was Coben's suggestion that, as I tried to suggest in the talk, that as we, so to speak, rise up, we're also stepping down constantly. We're
losing ego in my terms.
Yeah.
There's another thought that I have, this willful ignorance I have in my mind is something that the truly bigoted are into. And you have it in your mind is you don't know, which is kind of interesting, maybe just a semantic difference.
Can you say more about this willful, bigoted...
Thinking of the Congress as they walked out, delighted to have said no, and took a vacation. That to me is willful ignorance.
Well, that probably is a form of willful ignorance.
But it influences millions. It influences millions, so it's hard to... Maybe it's natural. Don't know mind.
I think there are many forms of this don't know mind, I guess our practice kind of includes it all, includes everything, and we try to navigate. I mean, we all do what Congress does. You know, it's not them and us. But embrace it all and find how to navigate that and how to transform that, so that it is truly creative and relieves us of suffering and relieves others of suffering, because others suffer from that kind of willful no, naysaying. So it's good that we notice the different forms that this ignorance takes, and that we can also notice that there are some very beautiful and helpful forms of ignorance too. Thank you. Did you?
Precursor to Plymouth College design, which is a lot of works. Engineers and architects with astounding will. Not so much maybe initially the improvisation, which is a word I came to when I was listening to you, especially with Miles Davis. And then just recently, last few seconds, I've been thinking Miles Davis, all those musicians. There's incredible, astounding will and tightness, rigidity to learn which then is, in, as you described, perhaps released.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a foundation there.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes from learning, from bigotry, ignorance, all the things that eventually allow that to happen. It's all encompassing in a certain way. And there's been metaphors talked about here in Zendo, or the Zendo is about children. I think this Miles Davis was not a child. What happened, which I'd like to hear, comes from an accumulation. So I don't need to go out into that rain and experience the incredible coldness and wetness to have, in a certain way, this artificiality of this roof to experience the intimacy of rain. I would want to get out of there. The rain, just like any animal would want to leave, and yet what we've done rather than gathering underneath a leaf, we have over history created this incredibly beautiful structure. No, the world is just incredible. So, I don't know.
Yes! Just let me comment quickly on that. That wonderful moment. That you just, I don't know, I felt that. And I had that same, thank you for allowing yourself to go, to get there. And I sort of did that by accident with one of my teachers, because I had all the, was ordained and got these robes, and I really didn't really understand what I was doing. I just was doing it as a kind of perfunctory thing. I'll get this over with. I've been practicing for 25 years. It's time. And I called my guide, my practice teacher, and I said, Diane, I got these robes and all this ceremonial stuff, and I don't know what I'm doing. I really don't know what I'm doing. She's known me for 25 years. And she said, finally! And I thought, okay. Now this is it. But I tried to make this distinction between this clean slate, I don't know, and the kind of I don't know that Miles Davis is experiencing, which is he's arrived there through this incredible discipline and hard life. I mean, I'm not going to separate his life and his art from each note that he plays. So it's not the innocence of a child at all. It's the achieved innocence. It's just coming out the other end of the gauntlet. And it's a form of baptism or purification. Before we go into the tea space, we stop and we wash our hands. We're not coming as children. We're coming with this, all this stuff. And it's our grist. It's the grist for our I don't know mind. So I, the reason why I think we are so astounded by the innocence of great artists is that they've been through it. They've been through hell often and have come out the other end. Also, Leonard Cohen has, in interviews has said that it's also not totally correct to say that without that suffering there wouldn't be great art, that sometimes the greatness of an artist is despite the suffering. because you do have to have your head together to make art. So it's complex. And I think we've touched on quite a number of the dimensions of this complex innocence. Thank you.